Sports' book, Can't Help Falling, A Long Road to Motherhood. You can go to CKUT-InTheMotherhood on Facebook, and you can email us at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more. Home of the Garvey plane, the Garvey wave in a former state. Mozambique, Tanzania, for Zambia, Mali and Ghana, Botswana, Somalia, Sudan, Gambia, Niger, Uganda, Rwanda, Ivory Coast, Comoros, Togo, Congo, Burkina Faso, Morocco, Guinea-Bissau, Gabon, and Guinea, South Africa, Egypt, Malawi, Chad, Djibouti, Lesotho, Liberia, Sao Tome, Principe, Seychelles, Cape Verde, Madagascar, Zimbabwe, Senegal, Nigeria, Cameroon, Angola, Mauritius, Benin, Ethiopia, Swaziland, DRC, Tunisia, Namibia, DR3.
Amanda, covering the continent weekly, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, welcome back to Amanda Radio here at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. It's another weekly broadcast with news and analysis from the continent of Africa. And Gwen, what's going on tonight?
So yes, welcome to Amanda. One of our go-tos here on Amandla is Africa is a Country. It's a fabulous website, has some tremendous essays and insights. We regularly consult it, and we encourage you, our listeners, to do so as well. They also have a smaller podcast section, and from time to time, we broadcast some of their podcasts, and that's exactly what we're going to be doing tonight. The podcast is called People See Women as Enemies of the Nation by William Shoki. And essentially what we're going to be focusing on tonight is gender-based violence, in this case in Senegal, and the pushback by feminists against that violence. In this, you know, this particular episode of the Upsurge of Violence had to do with the African Cup of Nations, but the discussion is much broader than that. So please take a listen.
If I could just add, Gwen, before we turn it on, when you go to that website for this, People See Women as Enemies of the Nation, there are four more article podcasts down below about rape culture in Nigeria, rape culture in Ghana, how Africa doesn't care about its women and neglects them as second-class citizens, and how to deal with sexual violence in South Africa. So that site is really rich.
Welcome back to the Africa is a Country podcast. My name is William Shoki, and if you are a regular listener and you did a double take at hearing me say the Africa is a Country podcast, well, you were justified in doing so. We have changed our name. It's a very subtle change. It's just changed from AIAC Talk to the Africa is a Country podcast. The reason for it, to be frank, I think it just rolls better off the tongue. And podcast gives you a little bit more freedom, a little more freedom to do with the medium what you must. Sometimes it might not just be talking, it might be music, it might be something else, who knows. But I assure you, if you are someone who has been with us for a while and our change to being a podcast away from the YouTube show was big, then this is probably going to be the last change we will make for a while. So don't worry, not many more changes are going to come. And thank you for sticking with us this while. And if you're new, well, then welcome. And a reminder of who we are and what we do. The Africa is a Country podcast is your weekly destination for conversations about current affairs affecting the African continent from a left perspective. You can find us on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts, Google, Stitcher, Apple, Spotify, as well as follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. And please give us a review. Tell us what you think. Tell us what you think of the changes. Unfortunately, Africa is a Country Talk to Africa is a Country podcast is one change to stay, so you can't change that. But if there's something else you'd change, then do let us know. We appreciate all of your feedback and all of your support. So to get on to today's program, we are going to have a conversation with Maram Gay as well as Kumba Touré about feminism in West Africa, particularly in Senegal, and how its recent scourge of gender-based violence is shifting consciousness on those issues, but not to the degree that we want. But before we get into that, a reminder of the conversation we had last week. It was a great one, first with Mametle Sabay from the General Industries Workers Union of South Africa about an ongoing strike against the South African dairy giant Clover, which was recently taken over by an Israeli company, and a company that began a devastating campaign of restructuring that has seen job losses and factory closures. So to hear more about the ways in which workers are not only striking, but also drawing connections between the oppression of Palestinians by Israel, check that out. And keeping with Israel as a theme, I also spoke to Naeem Gina from the Afro Middle East Center, which is based in Johannesburg, about how Israel is trying to get accreditation on the African Union and about the politics and maneuvers that are happening there. So that episode is now live. Check it out. And now for today's program. Joining us on the program to talk about feminism and gender-based violence in West Africa are Maram Gay and Kumba Touré. Maram is an associate professor of African and African diaspora literatures at East Carolina University. Her work explores gender, verbal, art, and migration. She's also an activist of women's rights in Senegal and its diaspora. And then Kumba Touré is the coordinator for Africans Rising for Peace, Justice, and Dignity, which is based in Dakar. She was born and raised in West Africa and is a writer and storyteller. She designs and produces a range of education materials and programs for children and young people through the Falia Artist Collective and Production House. And she has extensive experience in facilitating meetings, engaging young people, and designing and implementing and evaluating programs promoting peace and justice, especially for women. So those are just their short biographies. These women have tremendous experience working in the fields that they're involved in, and I feel really privileged to have them on the program today. Maram is a returning guest, so happy to have her back. So welcome to both of you. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
So it's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. So Maram, I wanted to maybe start with talking about an essay that you recently published for Al Jazeera. And I must say, it's a really striking and pertinent and important essay. So we're going to get to some of the topics I know you want to address. But this essay titled "To Whom Do Women's Bodies Belong?", which everyone should read, is laying out the landscape of women rights issues in Senegal and talks about a particular incident. So could you maybe begin by telling us about this piece and what inspired you to write it? And then we'll talk a bit about what the piece addresses.
Okay. I think I also want to put that piece in the context of the global issues about women's bodies. Because at the time when I wrote it, it was during the time where here in the US, where I'm based, people were talking about abortion rights and then talking about the Texas abortion law that actually allows anybody to sue a woman who did abortion or her doctor or anybody who helped her get abortion. So it's within a larger context of women's bodies and to whom do women's bodies belong that I wrote it. And the title was inspired by a question that Fatou Sow, the veteran feminist from Senegal, asked during a webinar that I participated, and she asked, to whom do women's bodies belong? And right at that time, in Senegal, one of the former Miss Senegal, her mother actually appeared on video saying that her daughter was allegedly raped and became pregnant from that rape and gave birth to a son. So she came public about that incident, and the then secretary of the pageant, the Senegalese pageant, commented that in an interview that if she were raped, then she saw it coming, or literally she wanted it because she's an adult and nobody can force her to do anything. So that infuriated us as feminists, as gender activists in Senegal and in the diaspora, and we talked about it a lot on social media. And because I am here in the US, sometimes I feel really hopeless and helpless in the sense that Kumba, for example, is over there in Senegal, and they are actually on the ground doing the groundwork. So for me, my way of participating and having my voice heard and participating in this whole discussion and as an activist is to write so that I can not only bear witness, but then so the whole world knows what is happening in Senegal. Because I think there is this kind of a, I have written about it before, this narcissistic view that we have of Senegal. Like, it's a democracy, it is a perfect country and whatever. But this peace is built on the bodies of women most of the time, and these stories don't come out. So what happened is that that woman, when she said it, of course it's outrageous. Of course it was just horrendous that she said that kind of, she made that kind of comment. But people really bashed her so much, rightfully so. But I think that the reaction was very different from when men and Muslim preachers go in public media and talk about women's bodies, talk about rape, or actually do the apology of rape, of pedophilia, and nobody says a thing. As a matter of fact, as I said in the article, Youssou N'Dour is employing somebody who was convicted of rape, and he's still on the platform every single day re-victimizing the victims again. And there are so many other cases, countless cases of that. So I think that there was a double standard in the way that this woman was treated. Of course, what she said was outrageous, but at the same time, everybody in Senegal talks about women's bodies, steps on women's bodies. I think there is a culture of paying lip service to women's issues without really doing much on the ground.
Mm. Kumba, would you like to add anything?
It's just so true. I agree so much with you, Maram. I think that it runs deep and it starts early. And we are conditioned, whether we're, you know, men or women, to accept and to tolerate violations on women, whether it's in the speech or it's physical. We accept it, we tolerate it very, very easily. And it's a lot of work. I mean, I was just commenting to say that the road is long, but it seems like we've picked up a pace though, somehow. It's harder now that you know, something happened without having at least, you know, somebody or some people speaking out. We might sound like minorities or not be taken care of or responded to, but the deafening silence has resolved in some ways, and that to me is beautiful. Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about something you've just said now, Maram, which is how people are often paying lip service to these issues, but the actions to try and meaningfully combat them are often lacking. And thinking to January 2020, when Senegal passed a law finally criminalizing rape and pedophilia, it makes me think of a conversation that's being had in South Africa, where I think there's a similar sort of disjunct between the laws that we pass in order to try and combat gender-based violence. And there's lots of talk from government authorities to speed up, for example, GBV cases in the criminal justice system, to be more punitive to people that commit gender-based violence. But there's very little attention paid to the sort of social and cultural factors which normalize rape culture, which, for example, as you were saying just now, Kumba, that targets the way we've been conditioned to accepting these ideas. So Do you think that this law is going to change much? Or, I mean, you've mentioned now that it's taken us a long way further into the conversations, but since its passage, how has it sort of changed the landscape?
I can say that, you know, the laws, they are needed, and we will continue to fight as much as we can to put the legal framework that, you know, people and particularly women can use when they need it. But yes, like you say, we know that having a law is not enough. We know it from a long time ago that people do not respect those laws. Those who are supposed even to enforce them are violators of them. When you know, women run out or come out of domestic violence, if you go to the police and find a policeman that is violent himself in his own family, or even when he's not, but consider that, you know, you should be listening to your husband, and instead of asking or checking on why you're not doing well, they're wondering, you know, they're trying to tell you, please just take it, and you should do this and that. They try to advise you on what you're supposed to do. So again, we have to change how people react to what happens to women and to women's lives. And that takes more than laws to yes. deal with. It takes yes. much, much more than laws. Thank you.
I think there is the laws are needed, and we are so happy that we have that law criminalizing rape, because it used to be that stealing a cow was much more severe than raping a woman in wow. Senegal. Literally, yes, it was. So yeah, it's shameful to say that, but that's the truth. So we are glad that we have the law, but now we need to combine all other aspects to be able to enforce this law. And that means education, that means advocacy, that means a lot of other things to do at the level of the greater society, but also at home, individually. And people need to be aware that these laws exist and that this is what's going to happen if you you rape or commit an act of violence against a woman. But at the same time, I think that the government itself, and this is not just on the law against rape, there are so many other things that have been voted that have not been respected. For example, we just came out of the local elections where they were supposed to apply the parity law, which has been passed since 2010. But still, you will find that at the head of the city halls and or whatever, they have maybe 5% of women when they were supposed to have 50-50. Or at least, you know, a bigger majority when it comes to women. But you see that even in these local elections that we just came out of in the last couple of weeks, you would find that the board has exclusively men, and they know that they're breaking the law. So it's up to us now and other activists to uphold that law, to tell them that, look, you are breaking the law, and we're going to sue you for doing this. Because as long as we continue to comply, these laws are not going to be applied. We also need to have more women at the level of judges, for example, who judge these cases of sexual violence, for example. We need to have more women to be able to represent women who have been victimized in this way. So there's a lot to do, and there are lots of things to combine.
And talking about a lot to do, I want to now come to how sexual assault is always kind of relegated to the fringes of national conversation. Maram, you brought it to our attention that once Senegal had won the African Cup of Nations, which is a tremendous feat, and one that I think everyone on the continent rightfully celebrated alongside them. In those celebrations, unfortunately, they were marred by tragedy when a number of women came forward and shared their stories of how they were assaulted by their fellow countrymen. So could you talk about how that conversation is currently happening, if at all, in Senegal, and how it's sort of emblematic of how, as you say, women's bodies are trampled on and ignored.
That conversation is not happening. We as activists are the ones who know about it. Mm. Nobody has talked about it at all. Even in the national media, nobody talked about it. When President Sall gave his speech and talked about the three people who died and others who were wounded, I was just sitting there thinking, okay, there are wounds that are not seen, and those are the wounds that women carry. So many women were, I'll just read one of them. Please. That was actually openly posted on social media. She says, this is the story of a little girl who, in 2002, cries in front of the TV like thousands of Senegalese. A little girl who sneaks into hotels to get dedications and autographed jerseys, and who grows up in hope. In 2022, so 20 years later, it is finally our year. She gloats to the point of losing her voice. She wants to celebrate with others, and then there are policemen and at every 10 meters. It should be fine. This is, she's talking to herself. She knows the drill, simple clothing, no valuables, take your private car, always in a group, away from the crowds. And yet a dozen men out of nowhere will decide otherwise. In 10 seconds, they take me away from the group. They throw me in the crowd to smother the scene. Without any suspense, violence, sexual aggression, and attempted rape follow. I bite my blood. I hit. I scream. I will end up getting out of it for some miracle. I love my country, but so often it hurts my heart. This star, meaning the soccer star that we won, I didn't imagine it like this. This is just one of them. Another one said that she was dressed in jeans and t-shirts. So you see how women are always taking the precaution to not appear sexy, yet they attack. Another one was wearing a hijab, and she and her 16-year-old sister were attacked. There was a deaf and mute 16-year-old who was gang raped. So all these stories are diluted. Nobody talked about it.
Thank you so much, Madam,
for sharing. I'll just stop there. I'm sorry.
Thank you for sharing this. I call them horror stories, but they are our everydays. And I want to say that I don't have that even fiber of the celebration that even, you know, Madam have, because first of all, you know, the way the sport is done and organized, I already feel completely out of it as a woman, and feel that the values that are given, the priorities that are set, are not most of the time looking towards women, towards poor people. No. So I tell you, as much as people celebrate, I have a hard time. I have a hard time celebrating, you know. And then, of course, I know when everybody was happy and all the kids went out to scream, you know, I stepped out to look and check, and in inside my belly, you know, something, you know, this fear come out. I know we are not safe in this crowd. Just by experience, by knowledge, by stories that we've heard, and it is automatic to check on the kids, on the young women, and making sure, please be careful, because we know that in that in these things that is glowing and everybody's happy, some people give themselves license, and somehow they think that women and women's bodies are part of the prize. If women's and women's body are part of the cup that the players have received, It yes. gives them license, and it gives them, the right to enjoy, something, because it's not considered as somebody with a will and a choice about this. So it's quite painful. The stories that you read, Maram, and the one that also, you know, took me really down is the story of the other young woman, the feminist, who went on Twitter and mm-hmm. who, of course, have gone through all the moments and all the times of violation. But again, on this day when she was just feeling so happy and come out to celebrate with everyone, you know, somebody, you know, grabbed her vagina and it just brought her back down to everything that she's experienced before. The fact that it's not even it's not considered as an issue, the fact that it's not part of the damage or the horror that people list is the normalizing that I was just talking about, and the level of tolerance of women's pain and women's suffering being part of just what people deal with. Yes,
and I will add that this, when I was sitting there, I mean, I celebrated, of course, and this begs the question about women and nationalism and what do you do? Do you celebrate your country, or do you just sit there because your country has hurt you? You are in the middle, literally, and you don't know what to do. And when I see this little girl who is 4 years old, who they have put her picture as the emblem of the victory because she was celebrating in the US and her picture went viral. And the Senegalese soccer organization put out a tweet looking for her, and they finally found her. And they actually flew her to Dakar, and then she came out of the airport in a very celebratory way. I'm thinking, this is the same girl, probably in 10, 20 years, that is whose body is going to be given. If she were to, like, this is the story of the girl that I read, the one in 2002, who was watching as a little girl. So we're celebrating this little girl right now. But 20 years later, there are people right there ready to jump on her and assault her. So there is this big, you know, contradictory demeanor when it comes to talking about girls and talking about women. So from when does this four-year-old move to this cute little girl that we celebrate, to the woman that we don't care about, whose body we consume as part of the prize, as Kumba has said. So all of those questions should actually be talked about openly so that we can have a national discourse about it. Because we know that soccer itself is violent. It is built on predatory grounds, not just in Senegal, but everywhere else. We have all these issues with soccer players in England, with sexual assault, and so it's everywhere. And they actually are vested in this idea of masculinity that does not see women as human beings, as people who belong to the nation, but they are actually part of things that we consume the same way that we would just grab a bottle of soda and drink after we have won. So this victory means that you have right to grab women to do whatever you want, and you cannot celebrate your country as a woman because you know what is awaiting you outside, as we've seen in all these stories. So it's really disheartening to see that everybody was waiting for this victory, but this victory is only good for men. It's only good for men. And
you know, Maram.
You
know, Maram, I've chosen my country. I am a woman. And that's my country to start with. I love, I am African, but I've chosen my country because I know it doesn't matter where I am from. You know, I am a woman, and it will be shown to me, and it will be shown to people who look like me. So that's my first step. But, you know, I need to also speak about another thing I saw that really shocked me in the celebration, in the midst of this celebration. There was this also image that went, I guess, viral for us because we saw it all over on the WhatsApp of this young boy who was crying. And people were asking him, why are you crying?
Yeah,
and
that.
He said, because Mohamed Salah is crying, the Egyptian guy. But this is a Senegalese boy. And you look at the video and people are not only teasing him, but even like, you know, being angry at him.
They were tormenting him, actually.
Aren't you Senegalese? Take off our shirt. And he was so brave, he took the shirt and threw it on the floor. And they were like, what are you crying about? We won. And I was looking at this little boy and thinking, okay, this is how you build a man that doesn't care. Yes, of course, Senegal won, and people can celebrate. But if somebody sees the pain of the team that lost and wants to cry with them, why is it an issue? Why do we socialize our young boys to be men who don't care about us? Why? So to me, this is a whole thing that really need to be looked at. The competition, the discarding of people, the you know, the fixation about, I don't know, billions that people make, as if that's what life is about. All of these things are connected.
And
it's not separated.
You are listening to Amandla Radio here at CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. What you're listening to tonight is an Africa is a Continent podcast.
Africa is a country.
Sorry, Africa is a country podcast. And it's about the situation facing Senegalese women after the winning of the Africa Cup earlier this year. So stay tuned for the rest of that podcast.
They are. And the whole celebration itself is very masculinist. When you saw the people who went to the airport to welcome the team, there was literally no women in that group. And yet, women are the ones who uphold the peace and try to make it. The reason why these women's stories actually did not come out in the national media, in part, was because the women themselves did not want to spoil the party. They did not want to spoil the party. Even us, even myself included, as I was writing and trying to write this as an article, I was thinking, is it too soon to even write this? Because people were so euphorically celebrating that if you come out and talk about sexual assault, they'll be like, well, look at the feminists again. They're always spoiling the fun. So I'm sure that part of the reason why these women, many of them did not go public, I mean, they talked about it on social media, but did not, for example, go to the police or something like that. They did not want to destroy or sour the national party that was happening. And that's always the case, because there is this incident that somebody wrote about on social media. There's a veteran reporter, sports reporter named Abdoulaye Diaw, that everybody knows in Senegal. And during the ceremony of that the president was receiving the Lion of Teranga, he said that he was not invited by the presidents and the soccer organization, but the first lady invited him. And in that gesture, what I saw is women always the ones upholding Teranga, smoothing seams and making sure that things are right, but nobody cares about what's right for women. That's how I see it.
Thank you so much to both of you. I think you've shared so much, and I'm really struck by this idea that runs through what you've both said, which is that the idea of the nation excludes women. And I think it's something that is very poignant to think about right now, because we're almost seeing a resurgence of nationalism in Africa. So thinking about the wave of coups that are happening in the Sahel, as Africans are apparently, so we are told, grappling with the question of whether or not liberal democracy works for them, or neoliberalism works for them, or whatever. I'm struck by how, when you think about all of these conversations, there's nothing about women, for example, you know, in these conflicts, in the military takeovers, in all of this. It's come down on me now where I'm just sort of realizing, like, oh my goodness, you know, there really is nothing about women, about how these conflicts have devastated the lives of women, how women are excluded from the conversations about what happens next in places like Mali or Burkina Faso or wherever it is. And I don't really have a question, to be honest, but just to sort of continue to probe, is this the sort of perennial problem of Africa, where since post-colonialism, we've just never included women as part of the nation? The idea of the nation, as you said, excludes women.
It's real. And when I say I know where I'm from and which nation I'm from, I mean it. Because when the laws, when you have still laws in Mali, you it's still authorized to mutilate women. We still have it. Come on, it's the country. Like when your country cannot protect you as a female body to be mutilated, what country are you in? How? When you start going to school and there is no way you can go to bathrooms, what country are you in? When you are harassed by your own teachers, when you go to work and have to fight, you know, your co-workers and your bosses, and when you turn to the justice of your country and people are laughing at you, what country are you in? When the country legalized that someone who has the same capacity, the same level than you, can and should make more than you, what country are you from? So if we look at it very clearly from that point of view, then you look at the representation, and Maram just talked about it. You go on to votings, you go on to places where people are in the government, in business, anywhere. And you are in the margin. Sometime some of you can be picked and put somewhere. If you're somebody's girl, you are not part of the story. The militaries can do their coup. They could bring down some men and bring some other ones. And forums can be organized so people can discuss what's the next thing. But when you've lived through all of those things, and here you are not part of it. It takes too much to even get your word heard. Go ahead.
I don't think any of this nationalism, these coups or anything include women. In fact, there is a disregard. When you have this disregard for life in general, you are actually disregarding and taking for granted the reproductive labor of women, because all these men you were killing were carried 9 months by women, men and women. So there is this taken for granted and actually this assuming that women are here just as reproductive machines, and then we can do whatever we want with their bodies and even the bodies that they produce. There is that one aspect. At the same time, when we talk about women within the context of Senegal or anywhere else, it is just in terms of consumption, bodies to be consumed. During the AFCON, before Senegal qualified for the final, when I think it was at the quarterfinals or whenever, when Kouyaté scored one goal actually, to give us the win. The whole discussion was about the fact that he has two wives, and they actually took that opportunity to talk about polygamy and use it as a segue to say that, well, polygamy is good, you need to have two wives, whatever. But all of this discourse is about women and how to consume them. It has nothing to do about bringing women into the conversation, making them as a priority in the country or in the nation. In fact, many women are seen as enemies of the nation, as especially feminists. So there is this whole violence against feminists, whether on social media or on the ground, that is meant to literally frame them as enemies of the nation.
What do we do? What is being done? Where can we see a light in a dark tunnel? I think we began this conversation thinking about what a modest success it was that this law in Senegal was passed. And I think, as you've rightly pointed out in other forums, feminists in Senegal are working tirelessly to put these conversations on the national table, to get the laws and frameworks that need to be passed, and to shift consciousness. How is that work going on? Maram, you've just said that feminists particularly are viewed as enemies of the nation. So what is the state of the fight at the moment, and what is the next battle that has to be waged?
Well, you know, to me, every time we speak about what's not happening, what we also need to do is talk about what is happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that, at least for me, witnessing the connections of the stories that really cross the borders. We're not talking about Senegal, Senegal.
This is South Africa. Talking about, this is Tanzania. This
all
is
Africa. And the fact that more and more those stories are connected, and women and men, realize that this is not particular to a country, to a specific place, but it's the whole systemic things to change. The realization of also that the harm that it does to all, not just women, but to everyone, the harm that it does even to, the more, capitalistic, the people more and more see that this doesn't make sense to, put on a side this many numbers of people suffering. Is not good for anything. And so to me, I see every day people moving, people trying, people responding to individual needs to start with, because you have to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just a case, but we know that a case is not just a case, because that one person going through that one issue, is representative to something bigger. Mm. So when we follow it and support, whether it's financially, whether it's by giving it visibility, whether it's by telling the story or giving some emotional support, what we are actually doing is breaking, a bigger curse than just what is happening with that person. And to me, that's phenomenal, because given the adversity, given the difficulties, given everything around us, that the possibility is there, and that there are some people, some women, some organization, some people who actually organize and make things happen, it gives me a lot of hope.
Mm.
Yes. There are so many organizations. I'm so happy that right now in Senegal, there is this large discussion among gender activists, feminists, who are helping, not only helping just to solve cases, like individual cases, for example, from their own money sometimes with the help of other people who donate, but at the same time, trying to organize, to have conversations about how do we tackle these issues? How do we do the strategizing? A lot of is happening via WhatsApp, for example, where people take case by case and talk about it and then develop strategies in order to solve them individually, but also put them at a larger context in order to dismantle really these patriarchal norms. There are organizations like, for example, Daffodoy that are doing they were behind the law of the 2020 law. One of the organizations, they are doing campaigns, for example, to actually advocate and let people know that rape is a crime, for example, and that this is what you're going to get if you are accused of rape. This is what's going to happen if you are charged with rape. So there are so many things happening, and some people are doing their best writing and making sure that they educate people. For example, we are very present on social media, engaging with people and going and doing webinars. Like there is a conference on feminism and gender violence that is happening next week in Dakar. That's going to be a larger one where all of us are going to be there, veteran feminists and gender activists, like the older generation, the next generation, everybody is coming in conversation. So there are so many things happening. Of course, like Kumba said, we always start by talking about what is not working, what is not being done. But at the same time, there is so much resilience. There is so much agency on the ground. And women are ready. They are not going to be quiet anymore. So that's the beauty of it. People are talking about it. Like they said in French, les langues se délient. People talk. So because people talk now, we are more aware. All these stories were shared, some intimately and saying that, okay, I give you authorization to share it. But many of these feminists are every single day on the ground, whether on social media or on the physical ground, working with victims, trying to do something and really talking amongst each other. So there are so many things happening. And like Kumba said, there is no stopping us.
I look forward to hearing more about what happens during this conference that you mentioned, Maram. And thinking to what you've just said now, Kumba, I was struck by how you addressed how a lot of this work involves making clear to even the people who are the apparent beneficiaries of the system that it hurts them too. And you mentioned capitalism. And I think increasingly around the world, we're realizing that we've reached the boundaries of capital accumulation and exploitation. We're devastating nature. Pretty soon, this planet is going to become uninhabitable for not only mankind, but all planetary life. And I think this is something that I'm not myself in whole agreement with, but I think it's interesting that capitalism itself is often viewed as being coded by a kind of masculinist logic, a logic of consumption, a logic of devastation, and so on and so forth. So it almost feels like we're now in a position where we're forced to think about not only an alternative way of organizing society, but an alternative way of relating to each other, one that is more compassionate and caring. And this often gets gendered, which I think is maybe can be problematic in itself, but that's how we often counterpose them. So, I mean, I'm interested to hear from you, especially. You're involved in organizing about a very important issue on the continent, which is about access to water. And there's efforts to sort of hold these continental forums on water, and you're organizing an alternative World Water Forum, one that foregrounds the experiences of women in trying to ensure water access and stability against sort of the privatized transnational companies and the like. Could you talk a little bit more about those organizing efforts and how, and I think it's something that gets lost, is that these other issues of organizing, thinking back to something you said, Maram, about reproductive labor, but also about social reproductive labor, about how when women are organizing for water, organizing for the protection of land or whatever it is, that's a feminist struggle. And that's something that we should also spotlight as feminist struggles.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, water issues are women's issues. It is, in the end, women's bodies and poor women's bodies carrying waters and looking for it and providing it for the families. You know, big capitalist groups can only thrive because in the end, women take the burden of the last throw. I always say it is the time when women strike and say, we are not doing it. We are not going, or we are not going to put the energy into something that things start changing. As long as we bear the burden, nobody realizes that, okay, things are working, it's moving, somebody's making money, but in the end, who is not making anything at all and giving for free her time, her sweat, her body to make things work? It's women. And yes, when we talk about change, it has to be profound change. It's not just about relationship between men and women. It's about how our societies are built and what we expect people to do and who we expect to do things for free and who expects for very little and who we expect to make, you know, the buck. And that's where it is extremely important that all struggles, whether it's struggles for environment, struggle for democracy, that they support and be part of the feminist struggle. Because feminist struggle is not and is so far from being about women. It's about changing power relationships that allow some people to dominate and allow the suffering, the killing, and the exploitation of some others. Well, women happen to be a big body of that, you know, suffering from that power imbalance. But they are not the only one.
I mean, do you think we will ever reach a point where, and thinking back to how you both mentioned earlier, that a sign of hope is the transnational solidarities that are being built, the cross-border connections that people are making. Do we think we'll ever reach a point, and there's been historical precedents, but where women on the terrain of social reproduction organize and strike and withdraw? They say en masse, no, we won't. I mean, I think that would be quite remarkable, as you just said, Kumba, where, you know, we always think that the bedrock of productivity in society is in the factory. It's in the goods and products that are made and that we consume as end products. But it begins at home, as you said. It begins with the person that has to collect the water that sustains the household and sustains the family. And if we begin to say that should be the locus of organization, before we talk about organizing at the factory gates, we talk about organizing at the home.
That's the beginning. That's the beginning, and that's where it starts. And we don't have a choice but move there. It's already happening. Even the, you know, this hype around violence against women, I tell you, I listened to the stories many times. Why did he beat her? She didn't cook the food. Well, you don't know how to cook and you're hungry. That's all. And you know you can beat somebody into making the food for you. But hey, the girls, they're seeing another life. They're not a cooking machine. They'll cook when they like it. And there is a whole generation that won't cook, don't like to cook. And they're facing a generation that don't think, or that is still thinking that they're in relationship with people like their grandmothers. And that's where the height of violence is happening most of the time, because we are not on the same planet. We are raising our girls to be strong, to be open, to shoot for the moon. Every other father is telling, oh, my girl will be this and that. And we are raising still our boys to live like dinosaurs. They will not find their matching counterparts. And they will be violent because they don't know how else to act.
Yep. That is That is what it is. That is what it is. I think you say it really perfectly, Kumbar. Bell Hooks has said that patriarchy hurts men more than it hurts anybody else. They just don't know it. And it is time that men come out of the dinosaur age and then see that women are not born with a spatula or a ladle in their hands. They socialize to cook for them. So now that socialization is breaking because us, this generation, we, our daughters, we are not raising them just to be cooks for a man or to exist for a man. We're not raising them. And also, I personally, I'm not raising my boys to think that they are going to be served by women. So when we start doing that, raising our boys to be self-reliant, knowing that they are human beings who were born with two hands, just like women, then we are moving somewhere. But you talked about something that made me think of this metaphor of, we were talking about the environment. And I think that the way we treat the environment is exactly the way we treat women's bodies. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. We have taken the earth for granted as our mother earth, and whatever she does is for us. But we feel not compelled to do anything for her. But we see that nature is telling us now that she actually has agency. So women are doing the same thing. They're not sitting around and just, you know, not doing anything. Of course, there are certain places where we have to help and really make sure that women are aware of what is happening to them. But there is this whole revolution that is happening. And that's exactly why there's so much gender-based violence, because men cannot take these changes.
I think that's a perfect place to conclude our conversation. I'm tremendously grateful to the both of you. It's especially, I think, enriching for me as a man, and understanding the way my own perspective has been shaped by my standpoint, to hear from the two of you. So I'm extremely grateful.
Okay. Thank you for giving us the space and to give, I want to say, importance to these conversations. It's something that we need. So thank you for making the space.
It wasn't mine thank to you. Give. You both created the space yourselves and held it well. And I was happy to listen. So
it's a real honor to share this with Kumbar, to share this space with Kumbar. I admire her. I admire the work she does. She's a warrior, and absolutely. You know, a warrioress.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Same here, Maren.
So I can't wait to see you soon.
Always happy to hear your voice and to see what you write and to read and to learn from you. Thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you, William.
Thank you. And to our listeners, you've heard we've had two great guests, a reminder of who they are, speaking to Maram Gay, who is an associate professor of African and African diaspora literatures at East Carolina University, as well as Kumbar Touré, who's a writer and storyteller and is the coordinator for Africans Risings for Peace, Justice, and Dignity. Thank you so much to the two of you. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. A reminder to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. Review us, tell us what you think, as well as follow us on social media. And I will be back next week with more interviews on topics related to African current affairs from a left perspective. Until then, goodbye.
So that pretty much wraps it up for us here on Amandla. Before you go on to listen to Jazz Euphorium, we have a little pitch to make, which is that Amandla is in, we've been on air for 30 something years, I've lost track, and we're in a little bit of a moment of reflection about where we want to take the show now. Do we want to restructure it? We're looking at change, and part of that is that our team is small now. It used to be big and sprawling. It has shrunk. COVID is partially responsible for that. There are other factors at play as well. So we sure would like to hear what any of your thoughts about where you would like to see Amandla go. You can contact us through our what's it called? Amandla.ca. Yes, you can reach us through Amandla.ca. There's a place there to write to us. If you would like to join us, if you'd like to contribute, you are always most welcome, and you can contact us the same way. So please, your thoughts, your reflections, criticisms, appreciations, everything is welcome and will be looked at very closely. So that's it for us now. See you next week.
CKUT 90.3 FM,
and we're back once again. This is CKUT Radio, and you are listening to the Jazz Segment with Hanzo the Bullfrog, coming to you live from the pond. Today I got a wide assortment of dope tunes from different producers, musicians, and artists that I know and don't know as well. But it's going to be funky, man. I'm hyped. This one I chose, I handpicked myself a bunch of fire tunes, and a couple homies sent me some requests. So, you know, we're going to get into it. Hope y'all had a wonderful week. And let's check these vibes out, you know what I'm saying? Shout out to the homies. Shout out to my man Wishbone Jenkins. Couldn't be with us here today, but show must go on.
I can feel the love in here. My inner space got constellations, and all those inner